When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
April 1805. Napoleon is master of Europe. Only the British fleet stands before him. Oceans are now battlefields.
April 1805. Napoleon is master of Europe. Only the British fleet stands before him. Oceans are now battlefields.
April 1805. Napoleon is master of Europe. Only the British fleet stands before him. Oceans are now battlefields.
April 1805. Napoleon is master of Europe. Only the British fleet stands before him. Oceans are now battlefields.
This is Podcaster and Commander, an audio documentary podcast series about the seafaring classic Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. The series will be an oral history of the film's conception and production, a discussion of the film's critical reception, and the increasing resonance in the now 20 years since its release.
Sighting. No, a sound. A reef marker. The bow of a ship. A wraith appears in the fog. The ghost of a ship. Like sighting one's death. The indecision here is so cruel. To beat to quarters is like smelling salts to sailors. It's a cold plunge. It's saying you have to wake up. The wolves are at the door. At the center of the frenzy, it's Midshipman Hollam, Lee Ingleby, who depicts a genuine suffocating anxiety at being required to make the call. He is nakedly afraid of this figure. We are the only ones who have seen what he has seen. And in that second, I don't envy his quandary. His junior and peer, Max Benitez's Mr. Calamy, is ready. A young man of action and assertion. He is, as Hollam should be, more handsome, more oriented. There's a kind of tragic realization in their tiny exchange that Hollam will be superseded. Then there's the crew who stare blankly into Hollam, whose silent judgment screams, will the uncertain glances of this panicked man cause an unnecessary frenzy? When Hollam won't act, Calamy will. In a way, it could reek of the very insubordination that would leave the crew at odds with Hollam and their perception of a curse later in the film. At this moment, it's a gesture of friendship. Calamy infers that the order came from Hollam. Despite the boundlessness of the ocean and the time that feels longer, the world that feels larger, the threats swollen with the anticipatory thinking time. When the drums beat, your heart races. Hunched, running through the bows and bounds, dismounting hammocks, hurriedly snatching up possessions, racing into positions. Despite the panic, it's rehearsed. Rooms peel away, non-essential items are stowed, coats are put on, sword sheaths are clipped. Like a well-oiled machine, the sailors are at their stations. First mate is in charge of the deck. Captain Jack Aubrey is on the bow, searching for this shape a mile off in the fog bank. Nothing immediately presents itself. Lucky Jack is staring off into the fog. A bell chimes on the deck, and just as this could all be an exercise in hypochondria from one of his subordinate watch commanders, Lucky Jack hears something on the breeze. His eyes sharpen. We come back to the focused point of view of a handheld telescope, scanning the impenetrable fog, when suddenly, from frustration to fiery intensity, an ambush is afoot. The game is afoot. From within the fog, a sudden rumbling light. The sonorous boom follows seconds after Jack screeches, "Down!" Cannonball strikes into showers of splinters. Steaming lead devastates the decks. Finally, the Acheron is revealed. The fog is misdirection. We're in the teeth of a crocodile. So who will beat to quarters with me on this voyage. One of the greatest living film critics, the author of a Walter Hill film, Tragedy and Masculinity in the Films of Walter Hill, my friend, Walter Chaw.
The nature of the poet and the artist and the musician, especially in the world, who you are just an instrument that wind blows through.
Professor from the Center of the History of Violence at the University of Newcastle and Napoleonic chronicler Philip Dwyer.
Feel to the opening scene, and especially with the sound effects, because I think Weir copies the same kinds of sound engineering techniques that were used in Saving Private Ryan.
Your narrator for the series is me, Ken Jacob.
Theme Doctor, Andrew Villa, and I am your captain, Blake Howard.
Episode 3, I Shot the Albatross.
Peter Weir is a cinematic romanticist. The central dramatic conflict of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, is between the violence of the British war machine and the sublime beauty of the national world, just as it is reflected in Russell Crowe's Captain Jack Aubrey and Paul Bettany's Dr. Stephen Maturin. Master and Commander's deep harmony with the British romanticists is most obvious in the tragic arc of Midshipman Hollam, young man whose stasis grates his shipmates to the point that he embodies the curse of the Acheron's pursuit. Here's Walter Chaw about the romantics William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the author of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and how he sees one of the great poems of that era reflected in every part of this seafaring classic.
Peter Weir is a romanticist poet, essentially, because he understands strongly the story of place. You know, even like the boarding school in Dead Poets Society, it's what sticks with me in my head is the grounds and what it looks like when they're riding their bikes across it, or the Mosquito Coast, absolutely. You know, the decay of capitalism and the fleeing to a verdant Eden, which turns out to be a lie. You know, there's pirates here too. There's monsters here. And so, you know, romanticism is this sort of longing for Eden and also a realization that the Eden was perhaps always a lie. So for the romanticists, you know, the first testament to God was nature. It wasn't the Bible. It was nature. And you saw things that were evidence of motivating principle, a watchmaker, everywhere around you in nature. And when we look at it as it applies to Master Commander, and there's so many ways to attack that film, but one really interesting way to unpack it is to say that this is truly a struggle between nature and the modern, nature and industrialization. On the one side, for Master Commander, industrialization is represented by Aubrey, is represented by this idea of, you know, being really good at being very navy-like, you know, and not scally, you know, but really not lubbery, but really navy-like, and this organization and this control over natural response, control over order, control over everything, and that's the one side. And the other side is the Paul Bettany character, the doctor, who is a naturalist, who is seeing things in nature as they are. And the course of Rime of the Ancient Mariner is that, you know, the mariner, he's as penance for this thing that he goes through. He has to tell his story over and over again. His story is,
and a good south wind sprang up behind. The albatross did follow, and every day, for food or play, came the mariner's hollow. In midst or cloud, on mast or shroud, it's perched for vespers nine. Whiles all the night, through fog smoke white, glimmered the white moonshine. God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross. And I had done a hellish thing, and it would work em woe, for all averred I had killed the bird that made the breeze to blow. Ah, wretch, said they, the bird to slay that made the breeze to blow. Nor dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun uprist. Then all averred I had killed the bird that brought the fog and mist. 'Twas right, said they, such birds to slay that bring the fog and mist. The fair breeze blew, the white foam flew, the furrow followed free. We were the first that ever burst into that silent sea. Dropped down the breeze, the sails dropped down. 'Twas sad as sad could be. And we did speak only to break the silence of the sea.
He murders an albatross right at the edge of an ice field, essentially. Their ship has escaped. And it sends them into a doldrum where there's no wind and the sun beats down on them. And there's a doldrum, indeed, in Master Commander as well. And he's blamed, the mariner's blamed for their bad fortune for shooting the albatross. And what's not often remembered about the poem, I think, is that initially all of his shipmates celebrate him shooting it. They're saying, you know, hey, we were in the mist, we're in the fog, you know, but you shot the evil seabird and now we're in the sunlight. Good for you. Good job. So they're all sort of complicit in this, coined the idea of a point of view as a metaphor. Coleridge is the source of it. The thing about the Ancient Mariners, it's about the moment that he breaks the curse, you know, of this act of random violence where he shoots the albatross for no reason and is forced to wear it around his neck. The moment that he's forgiven in a way is the moment that he sort of blesses unconsciously, just sort of feels joy when he sees living creatures after not seeing anything alive for a long time. All of his crewmates have died. This is a terrible scene. And the only he can't even speak because his mouth is so dry. He has to bite his arm so he bleeds into his mouth so he has enough moisture to speak. It's a terrible scene. He's almost dead. And he looks over the side of it and he sees these sea snakes. And earlier he's seen the sea snakes. He's compared himself to them. He's like, slimy things survive, and so did I. He's one of those foul creatures. But he sees them later in the poem, and he blesses them. He's like, oh, tears, you know. If he could cry, he would cry at that moment because he sees something alive and vibrant. He's like, oh my God, this is evidence for the romanticist, evidence of God in nature. So the albatross falls from his neck, you know, and in a way he's forgiven himself in a way because he's seen design, a great design in life. And so Master Commander similarly plays with these ideas about how, why are they in the doldrum? Is it because Jack has pulled him away from the naturalist thing in the sort of personal pursuit? And it's poignant to me that that's the moment that they have that great scene where, you know, the doctor says, look, this is are we talking as friends or am I talking to my captain? Because as friends, you're making this personal, and as a captain, good job, you know, I'll follow you to the ends of the earth. But as a friend, this doesn't seem like, you know, the job anymore.
If you please.
They're exhausted, Jack. These men are exhausted. You've pushed them too hard.
Stephen, I invite you to this cabin as my friend. Not to criticize nor to comment on my command.
Well, should I leave you until you're in a more harmonious frame of mind?
What would you have me do, Stephen?
Tip the ship's grog over the side.
Stop that grog.
Nagel was drunk when he insulted Holland. Did you know that?
Stop 200 years of privilege and tradition. I'd rather have them three sheets to the wind on occasion than have a mutiny on my hands.
You see, I'm rather understanding of mutinies. Men pressed from their homes, their chosen occupations, confined for months aboard a wooden prison.
Stephen, I profoundly respect your right to disagree with me here in this cabin, but I can only afford one rebel on this ship. I hate it when you talk at the surface in this way. It makes me so very low. Do you think I want to flog Nagel? A man who stood beside me on the gunwale and hacked the ropes and sent his mate to his death, under orders, under my orders. Do you not see it? The only things that keep this little wooden world together are hard work, discipline.
Jack, the man failed to salute.
For God's sake, Stephen, there's hierarchies even in nature, as you've often said yourself.
There is no disdain in nature. There is no humiliation.
Men must be governed. Often not wisely, I will grant you, but they must be governed nonetheless.
That's the excuse of every tyrant in history, from Nero to Bonaparte. And I, for one, am opposed to authority.
Your opposition is not my concern.
Misery and oppression.
You've come to the wrong shop for anarchy.
And so there's industrialization taking over and warfare and all this industrialized murder at war with knowledge and the accumulation of knowledge and seeing design in nature. And discovering things in nature. And so that's the push and pull of Master and Commander between these two people, these two men, but also, you know, on a grand macro stage, that's what the film is about, what is it that we should nurture in us? Yeah, we're apes in clothes. You know, we are like in the liminal place between those two things, and we are the arbiter of these things. You know, we are the arbiter of what we allow to survive. That's the, you know, we're struggling with it now, you know, with you know, do we continue to pollute the earth or do we try to save it? Maybe too late. And so, but there's also, but that comes from the Ancient Mariner, where when the albatross first appears to the crewmen, they're feeding them worms that they've taken from the bread. You know, there's all of these notes from the poem are literally in the film. The whalers that they free are on a boat called the Albatross.
Yes.
The idea of, you know, there's one person that's responsible for them being in the doldrums is, you know, of course, in the shipman who drowned himself in there. But, you know, there's even images where they talk about...
And he captures a cannonball, which is literally, you know, figuratively...
Exactly right.
The albatross is the cannonball around the mariner's mm-hmm. neck for the entirety of this epic poem.
And that's one of the images that Coleridge uses about men, you know, when they sink in the water, they sink down like lead. So he's holding the sort of lead ball as he's going down in the water.
It's imminent. Jonah. He's causing it. He's calling it up, don't you see? Time he's on watch, that ship appears. You wait and see. Anytime tonight, that ghost ship's gonna turn up. It's gonna take us all with it, straight down to the hot place.
Mr. Holland, you gave me such a start. You feeling better now?
Yes. Much better, thank you.
Captain thinks we'll get our wind tomorrow.
I'm sure of it. You've always been very kind to me. Goodbye, Blakeney.
Language, the images, the intent of the meaning of the poem and the meaning of romanticism is evoked by Master and Commander in this way that I don't believe can be unintentional. Yes. Not entirely, you know, and you don't have to be a Coleridge scholar or a scholar of British romanticism to just sort of get it. You know, there's this versus this, it can happen without having a familiarity with it, but it just seems like it's so closely tied that I feel like I want to speculate. But anyway, even without knowing, you know, it doesn't really matter if it was based on, you know, that death of the author. It doesn't really matter. Ultimately, what Peter Weir's movies do for me, though, is the same things that British Romanticism did for me. And, you know, made that was actually what I studied in graduate school, was British Romanticism. But, you know, what spoke to me so much was this feeling of longing, this feeling of wanting something that never existed. You know, it's people think, you know, British Romanticism, that means, you know, Fabio on a book cover or something. It's like the opposite. It means real sadness at something that you've lost and maybe you never had to begin with, that everything that you believed you could achieve or believe that you could be is ultimately perhaps a lie, that is not actually real. You can't really get there. And, you know, another interesting thing, a fascinating thing about Coleridge, which explains perhaps some of the supernatural element of Master Commander, where after the suicide, the wind does indeed pick up, right? Mm. Something that Coleridge really believed in was this idea that the imagination of the individual, you know, this is way before Einstein, right? The imagination of the individual creates reality. Yes. As you go, you know, that they are strong enough to create. There's a great Dan Simmons short story called Isaiah Dare Not Meet in Dreams that he turned into a novel called The Hollow Man. And it deals with this issue as well, which is that you individually create reality as you go. The things that you see, the things that you believe, the things that you want. And this isn't some sort of like hippie, like think good in the world, but more of a literal quantum idea that your perception fuels reality. You know, the Schrodinger's cat thing, if you can't see it, it's both things at the same time kind of thing. It's like your perception and your ability to perceive certain things is reality. And there's that great moment right before, you know, the suicide where Aubrey reveals that he believes in the superstition. And the doctor's like, oh, no, you too. I'm a man of science. But I just thought you. But he does believe it. And as he's giving last rites and he's saying the prayer, you know, he kind of glances up at the corner of his eye and he sees the wind filling the sails. That's his belief speaking the reality into the world and the perception of all of these men, you know, who feel bad, but he had to die, you know, that they believe it enough that it's become real. And that's something that Coleridge sort of introduced as an idea early on. And the Romanticists, you know, I love them too, because they're, whatever they were, they're all really just a bunch of like, humanists and atheists, you know, they believe that God was created in the heart of man and not the other way around. And so they're the creative element in their own universes, right? And so just so Aubrey and what he believes is what creates the reality of the film.
We'll be right back with more Podcaster and Commander after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At the beginning of the film, we see an ominous utensil drawer of surgical instruments unfurled, before the thunderous shaking of a boat and blood spurts from wounds play havoc with the footing of our medical professionals. So here's Professor Philip Dwyer from the Centre of History of Violence at the University of Newcastle in Australia to discuss the depictions of violence in Master and Commander. And as a premier Napoleonic scholar himself, share his impressions of the rendering of the world.
Yeah, there's that, which I think the film does really well. And the other thing it does, which a lot of films, not only from this period, but lots of other war films shy away from, is that is the role of children in warfare. So all of the midshipmen in this film are around the age of 13, apart from the hapless 30-year-old midshipman who commits suicide. And that's, and of course, that's how young they started out. I mean, Nelson was 13 when he first joined a ship as a midshipman. So it's a very, very long apprenticeship, and they're expected to know every in and out, so to speak, of any ship before they're old enough to take command. But being so young, they also confronted at times, of course, with the utter violence and terror that is a naval battle, which I think this film, again, and I'm sure lots of other people have said this, does particularly well, I think, because you see the full impact of what damage a cannonball can make, not only on the ship itself, but on the people in it. And the manoeuvring around, you know, how to best position yourself in order to have maximum impact on the opposing ship. It does all that very well. And of course, the British were very good at this because they trained their men particularly well at firing and loading. And there's a scene in the film where they practice this, the gunning and trying to get the time down. I think on average, they're expected to fire about every 90 seconds from memory or something like that. Wow. Which is a bit of a feat in itself, because you know the pulleys and the wadding and the shot and then the cannonball, all of that had to be loaded, and then you had to aim and fire or wait to be told to fire more likely.
Timing? 2 minutes and 1 second, sir.
Lads, that's not good enough. We need to fire 2 broadsides to hurl 1. You want to see a guillotine in Piccadilly?
No!
You want to call that raggedy ass Napoleon your king?
No!
You want your children to sing the Marseillaise?
No!
Mr. Mort, Mr. Pulling, starboard battery!
A bullet wound or a deep gash might have been enough to kill you because it easily got infected. So if you got shot in the leg or in the arm, as we see with this young midshipman, then an amputation is the way that you go. There's no sort of patching it up and hoping for the best, because it would become infected in that case, and then you'd have to cut off the arm anyway. So it was sort of a preemptive kind of surgery, very basic surgery, if you like. I mean, what we, you know, often fail to remember is that there's no anaesthetic, so these guys are clamping down on leather strips in order to. So, you know, I think there's laudanum possibly, but that's about it. And I think it might have only been local, or they might put you out a little bit, or they try and get you drunk a little bit in order to sort of allay the pain. But none of that worked terribly well. So you could die just as much from the shock of surgery as you could from the wound itself.
Yes.
And rates of death were high in this period, both on land and at sea, because of the poor state of surgery and care for the wounded after battle. And that's why we get the higher rates. It's not so much you are killed in battle, which could happen on a higher scale in some battles more than others. You know, during the Napoleonic Wars, we have the largest battles, land battles, that have ever taken place in history up until that point in time, with hundreds of thousands of men and thousands of cannon on each side. And it's the cannon that often cause the greatest harm.
Yes.
But it's the deaths as a result of wounds in the weeks and months that follow that usually make up the high toll, so that anywhere up to about 50% of an army could be killed in that way. It's really interesting the way you get a glimpse of the kinds of civility that exists on board ship. Now, people might think that's just being English, but there is a very specific purpose to that, and that is to train men to remain cool and calm and polite under pressure, so that when it does come to combat, everybody is sort of, you know, bringing it down a few notches in order to remain calm, cool and collected. So there was a very specific purpose to that English civility that I don't know if it existed in other navies of the world at the time, possibly the emerging American Navy, but I'm not sure about the French and the Spanish, the other two really big navies at the time. part of the civility is that that's the flip side of the discipline that has to be maintained on board these ships. And this is a smallish frigate with a, I think, what, 50-something people on board. Mm. But the two things we have to understand is that British naval crews are made up of a real collection of different nationalities. I mean, men were pressed into the Navy. Often they didn't volunteer to go in. And because they're not volunteers, the discipline is quite harsh, especially to the modern viewer. So flogging was quite common. We see an instance of that when a crewman is disrespectful to an officer and deliberately physically bumps into him. That kind of thing would just not be tolerated. So that's, I think, a good example of how captains had to be extremely harsh. But what the men would probably consider to be fair, if the guy stepped out of line for whatever reason and did something like that, then the rest of the men around him probably would have thought that he deserved what he got.
Yeah.
But we're looking at crews of lots of different nationalities. So when you see captains talking about England and this is England, I don't know to what extent the men on board would really care all that much, so much as that they have been, well-trained, they've been drilled for months and months on end. They probably haven't seen land for months and months on end. There is nowhere else to go. It's a question of life and death for them. I don't think that they would be terribly, patriotic in the sense that we would understand it. And you may also find that there were Frenchmen on board, for example, fighting French ships, or Americans on board who are fighting American ships, and so on and so on. And interesting to see, there's only one black character that I've noticed on the ship, but there would have been lots of black sailors in the day.
Yes.
And depending on the kind of ship and the nationality, they were more or less well integrated into the crews. There wasn't that kind of segregation and racism that existed possibly later on, and possibly on American warships in particular into the 19th century. But so I thought that was an interesting little thing. Patrick O'Brien does his research, and this was based upon something he found in the archives, apparently, about two ships' captains who were pursuing each other, one American and one British. The life of the captain, the British Captain Aubrey, is loosely based upon that of Thomas Cochrane, who was a bit of a bad boy in the British Navy, and who had the habit of pissing off his superiors, and therefore never able to advance very far beyond the rank of captain, and was always given these crappy little ships, frigates, to captain in the hope that he would, just be forgotten about. He did the kinds of tactics that we see in the film of, subterfuge, of hiding in the fog, of pretending that the ship was something else, of flying different colours, and then at the last moment turning out. All of those kinds of strategies were practised by captains during the wars, in the hope that, it was a chess game of some sorts on the high seas, or a game of cat and mouse, if you like. So every possible game in the playbook was used in order to trick the adversary and in order to capture the ship with, again, the least amount of damage possible, if possible. The only time we do see large amounts of sailors and ships being sunk are in naval actions between two naval sides, sort of like Trafalgar or the Battle of the Nile and so on.
Yes.
But when we're dealing with naval ships trying to capture prize ships, which are usually merchant ships of one kind or another, then there wasn't the need to sink it. What the game was to, use it
to catch it.
To enrich oneself, yes.
Actual fact, Mr. Blakeney and I did make one very interesting find.
Is that right? Let me guess. A stick?
Tell him about it, Mr. Bing.
It's a rare phasmid, sir.
A phasmid?
It's an insect that disguises itself as a stick in order to confuse its predators.
Yeah. And the only thing I felt, the other technical bit to it I found interesting was the thing about the oak.
Yes.
And the different types of oak. So this was an American oak. I don't know if the British used that American oak to build their warships, but the Americans certainly did. And apparently, yes, Cannonball did bounce off it. It was so hard, unlike the white oak that the English were using, which is quite fragile in some respects.
There's something beautiful about Master Commander because it expresses to me the hope that we can still find a common ground. You know, here's Aubrey with the doctor saying, hey, thank you for showing me the stick insect. I had never considered that a study of nature could feed into a study of naval battle tactics. And the more that we could get close here, right? And the film really, right, is about this.
I love that Stephen immediately is like, I don't know if that was a good idea.
It's like, fuck. Yeah, Stephen's like, you know, like Nobel after he invented dynamite, right? It's like, no. Fuck. There's something beautiful, though, too, about being able to see order in nature and design in nature. And that's what, you know, that's what he's all about. He's, you know, the doctor, he's like, you know, yes, God causes them to change, but what if they cause themselves to change? You know, so all of these lines become very poignant to me now when I look at it as a story about two men with different ideologies and different ideas about the structure and order of the world coming together because they're friends,
yes,
because they respect each other, because they're allowed to, he allows them into the room to speak to him openly, and he's listening, and because they love each other and they're listening to each other, and they're bound by love of music, and they're bound by, you know, things that are ineffable, help them achieve sublimity. Music for the Romanticists was the purest form of expression through the arts, because you can't describe it. You know, there's nothing that you can do to tell. I can't tell you what it's like to hear the Beatles for the first time. And so there's something about Master and Commander that's so beautiful to me, because it is about a sharing of ideas and a respect for each other's ideas and an acknowledgement that we so seldom have anymore, that all of our beliefs are stemming from the same sort of things. We're just coming at it from a different way, and that doesn't make you the devil, and it doesn't make me the devil. You know, we're somewhere in between here. If we can just sort of learn from each other instead of immediately discounting the one or the other, there may be hope for us. And whether or not I believe that anymore, I don't know if I do, but Master and Commander for me, it plays for me now like Royal Tannenbaums, you know, one of these movies where I can't watch more than 10 minutes of it without crying.
Yeah.
And it's so wistful, you know, and I don't think that's the intention of the film. It's not like Bright Star or something, you know, it's not that kind of film, but, you know, just showing the kindness, the fear that he has for Blakely, you know, it's like, yes, father will understand what's the life, but the mother, you know, these little things oh my God. You know, and the responsibility he has and for Blakely, and Blakely comes up at the end. It's like, sir, I'm sorry, but I was just told that I'm not going to get to, you know, go fight the bad guys. And he's like, no, I need you here. When we're done, you're taking over the ship. Like, taking over the ship, sir. Thank you, sir. Like these little moments of being a good dad and a good manager and a good friend and a good man, a good person.
Good person.
In the world destroys me. When he thinks his friend is going to dead, they take him back to the Galapagos so they can, he can like honor the promise that he made to him. I mean, the way that you move the world, the wake, if you'll pardon the image, the wake that you leave in the world has to be positive. It has to be positive. There's nothing else.
No.
There's nothing else that I can, you know, and I love that little throwaway line too, that he's like, we have to kill him before we declare peace. with a French, you know? It's like, there's a meaninglessness to what he does, and he realizes that, you know? But he also, because of the wake that he leaves, when he gives the captainship to the young man, you know, at the end of it, it's like, that's amazing, you know? And he says,
here, well, even with Mr. Pullings, when he gives him yes, the assignment, it's exactly, just...
it's, you know, this is a mentor who is seeing his, you know, like in The Last Jedi, right? Yeah. It's like the thing about mentors is that your students outgrow you. And here he is, like, finding joy and meaning in helping somebody get to the next place, helping somebody achieve the things that they want to achieve in their lives. You know, there's nothing else for us here than that. That's it.
Podcaster and Commander is produced by Blake Howard on the far side of the world.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.